All right, guys, welcome to the show. This is Deborah Gets Red Pilled. This is a Patreon exclusive. Deborah, are you there?
I am here.
How's your day going?
Very nicely. It's 90 degrees.
90. Wow, that's hot.
That's hot.
It's
Nope.
75, maybe a little hotter here, and man, I had a fantastic day. It's
Oh,
amazing
good.
what it was sunny yesterday and it's sunny today. First days of sun and no rain in a long time. And boy, tremendous. I had such a good day. I spent the whole day
Yeah.
working in the future garden and then running a chainsaw and driving the tractor. So the whole day. I got
Cool.
sunburned. I couldn't
Very
be
nice.
happier.
I think I did too.
I went out to the side of the barn and I put the brush hog on the tractor, cut down some trees, and started taking the land back from the blackberries. So I probably got about a quarter acre back today of my land that I've never touched because of the blackberry bushes.
Wow.
Yeah, so I'm
On
gonna
the far
start.
side of the barn, kind of
Yeah, like down by
where the
the
creek
creek.
goes.
Yeah. So I'm gonna start taking a little bit every day as long as
Yeah.
it's dry out, and it's gonna get drier and drier so I don't get the tractor stuck in the mud. And it's actually not muddy over there. So yeah, it's gonna be fantastic. I can't wait. It's so much, couple acres of land that I've never even touched because you can't get in there. And I'm just gonna start chipping away at it little by little, cutting down there's all these like invasive species little sapling trees that are super big now, but you know they suck. They have thorns all over them. So I'm cutting those out and yeah, it's going good though. But how's besides the hot weather and everything else, how's life?
Life is good.
Yeah.
Life is good. Just, same old, same old. Had dinner with your folks
How'd
Sunday.
that go?
It went really nice. It went great. And then your mom and I walked yesterday.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah.
I'm glad you guys are getting along and spending
Yeah, I have
time
a good
together.
time with her.
Yeah, I think they're really happy that they moved up there.
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
Sounds like they are.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but that's the only thing that's been going on with me around here.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't been doing much around here either. Just animal stuff and homestead stuff. I asked you to come on early so we could do a little intro. I thought I'd have more to say, but I
How's
don't
Boris
know.
doing?
Boris is doing great. He's such a fun little guy. I don't know if anybody wants to know. We're talking about Boris, my new little Great Pyrenees puppy. It's incredible what those dogs can do out of the box.
Really?
Like we got him when he's like less than 3 months old and he just stays outside. He lives outside, has no supervision. Can you imagine doing that with any other kind of
Oh
puppy?
my God, no. They would howl and
Yeah, he can go in the barn. He sleeps in the barn all day. He potty trained himself so he doesn't go to the bathroom in the barn where he lives. And yeah, he just runs around with his two little bottle baby sheep. He loves them.
it's
And
so cool.
yeah, he follows me around. He gets happy when he sees me all the time and he shows his
Oh.
belly. And yeah, he's good. Plays with the other dogs. You know, Wilma and him get along really well, which is always the one that I'm worried about because Wilma's a pit bull that's kind of mean to other dogs sometimes, but she generally likes boy dogs. So,
Yeah. That's interesting because that's the same with Avery's female pit bull.
yeah, they don't like other girls, that's for sure. So, but yeah, I'm really happy. I think we got a good one, and I think he's just super smart. And I don't think I'm gonna have to train him very much. I think he's just
That's
gonna know what to do. I have to.
just so great.
Yeah, I have to tell him like no when he's playing a little bit too much with the little sheep. He can play with them a little bit, but he can't, like, he's not supposed to, like, bite them or, like, play with his teeth at all with them. Uh-huh. And he's got to, we got to make sure that he knows that they're not, he's not
siblings.
We got to make sure he knows he's not a sheep. But it's pretty cool. Like, sometimes he'll follow me, like, when I'm walking up to the house, and then he'll just, like, lay in front of the little staircase ramp thing that goes up to the porch. And that's him protecting
just wait the property. For you.
Yeah. So.
So cool.
Yeah, he's getting big. He's like 40 pounds.
God, how much? Yeah. Do you know how much he weighed when you brought him home?
20 pounds.
Gosh.
Yeah.
So in another couple weeks, he's going to be 60 pounds.
Maybe 80 pounds. Maybe he's going to keep doubling. But yeah, we're feeding him raw chicken wings and raw ground beef and rice and sweet potatoes. So he's doing good. All the other sheep are good. Yeah. It's,
when are the other two going to deliver?
I don't know. I mean, if I go by... It should be like in a 3 weeks, but they're so big. Cause we got them at the, I got Lambert, the ram, in the middle of December. And then they came over a couple days later.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And it's 5 months gestation. So,
So, yeah. Could be soon.
Yeah, I think they're both gonna have twins for sure, maybe triplets, because they're both enormous. So hoping for triplets, hope for a lot of girls.
And they've had a litter. What do you call,
I don't know, sheep? It's not called a litter. A group of sheep. Flock. Yeah, they've had babies before.
They've had babies before, yeah.
Yeah. But
awesome. Cool. So I got this book.
Oh, the Tavistock Institute. Who's it by?
It's by Daniel Estulin.
Oh, Daniel Estulin. Yeah.
Yeah, there's another book that is like really hard to find. It's another one of those $3,000 books that I listened to some of Courtney's podcasts.
Oh, cool.
And they mentioned the other author and said it was really, really good. But this guy covers about the same stuff. So
yeah, he's a good researcher. He wrote the Bilderberg Group book.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, I just listened to a show with Jay Dyer and him.
Mm-hmm.
He's like an Italian guy, I think. So yeah, he knows his stuff. And yeah, I've become more and more interested in kind of this stuff, and less and less interested in more of the woo-woo stuff like that. I'm more interested nowadays in what the power elites are doing to shape society. And I'm, you know, I know I probably talk about it more than people want me to, but Jay Dyer's the best for it. And he goes through the texts that they have written. He's not going through speculative conspiracy books that are, what's going on? Yeah, so he goes through just like the books that these people have written and tell you exactly what they're mm-hmm. going to do, and goes through, like, I just listened to, he just did a, I paid for his, a subscription to his, you know, thing. It's $5 a month. And, you get all the second halves of everything that he does. And he had this, Aldous Huxley, lecture that he did at Cal Berkeley in like the 60s, where he lays it all out there. He tells everything. He tells everything that's going on right now that that's what they're going to do. And it's just amazing. And then
breaking up again.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm going to keep going, and because it doesn't break up on my end on the recording. So I'll just keep going.
Okay.
But
all right.
Our guest is in the waiting room. I guess we could bring him in early. But yeah, so guys, like I don't think we're going to do a bunch of weird. And that's why I like all the serial killer stuff too, because I think it's all related to that. Oh, you know what? What movie I watched the other night, and Emily said that you're a huge fan of it, and I had no idea. Jacob's Ladder.
Yes, I love that movie. The first couple times I watched it, I didn't have any kind of awareness about, you know, like Agent Orange or whatever, you know, mustard.
I mean, it's about MK Ultra. It's about Operation Phoenix.
Uh-huh.
Which
yeah.
is what all
I,
those
I did not I because yeah. I have not seen it recently. I didn't attach MK Ultra to it, but yeah.
Like the Phoenix That's program pretty, was where they trained all these psychopaths. I'm not frozen on my end, so I'm going to keep going. They trained all these psychopathic guys in Vietnam to go conduct all these guerrilla operations and like do all this super gnarly stuff that would scare the Viet Cong. And then those guys came back and they became the serial killers of the 70s and 80s. And that's what Jacob's Ladder is hinting at. So that, I remember I watched that movie.
I'm going to have to watch it again with a fresh eye.
Yeah, I watched that movie when I was a little kid and it scared me bad. The part where he's in hell in the hospital. Oh, man, that part. I watched it the other night when Emily was out of town. And I was here by myself. Man, it's scary.
Yeah. And when he's at that party and they're dancing and.
Yeah. But do you remember the part where he's like on the gurney and they're like wheeling him through that mental institute?
Yes.
And like, yeah.
Oh, what man. A nightmare.
I think that's supposed to mean that he's in hell.
Huh.
I think that's where he is. And what else? But it was really. That movie was made in 1990, and it's just incredible to watch movies that were filmed on film.
Uh-huh.
Like how much more enjoyable it is to see a movie that's on film that's not a digital recording, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've never paid attention to that because usually I'm on my laptop at the same time.
Yeah. Apparently there's another one, a new one, a remake that came out in 2009.
I think I saw that. It didn't impact me the same way, though. I think I saw it. It was with a black man.
Yeah. I'm going to watch it also, but I doubt it'll be anywhere near as good.
Yeah.
But we're supposed to do a show with these guys who have a show called PsyOp Cinema.
Mm-hmm.
They do really good work. They go super deep on all these movies. And they asked me what we wanted to do a movie on, and I couldn't think of anything. And I think maybe we should do that one.
Yeah, that'd be good.
But yeah, guys, go back and watch that one. It's scary. There's a couple parts.
Yeah,
there. Just,
it's a good movie.
It's got Macaulay Culkin in it.
I don't remember that. But...
That's his dead son is Macaulay Culkin.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right. So doesn't he go up the ladder at the end, the final part of the movie?
No, he dies. He dies in a field hospital in Vietnam.
Yeah, but
and it just ends. So the whole movie, I think what it happens is that's like his hallucination while he's dying in a helicopter after. It's weird. Those guys, hopefully we can get into it with those guys. But the ladder, Jacob's ladder, the ladder is what they called because the story is they caught this hippie dude who's making LSD said, you're either going to go to prison or you can come to Vietnam and work on this project with us. Made him like synthesize all like the super bad parts of an LSD trip that would take you down to like base fear and anger. And that's what they called the ladder.
Oh, boy.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I got to watch it again.
Yeah, terrifying film.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's pause and let our guest in. All right, guys, we're back, and we are here with our guest today, Courtney Turner. And do you say Courtney or Courtney?
It's Courtney, but okay. Yes, a lot of people like to call me Courtney.
Yeah, right on. We're really happy to have you here. I've been a fan of your work ever since you kind of popped up on the scene. And you've got a really interesting story, because from what I've heard you talk about, you kind of got to this point of being like pretty well versed on some of the secrecy of what the elites are doing pretty fast. Is that right?
Yeah, the joke I like to make is that it took me a really long time to find the train stop, but then I tried to find the high speed rail, and I'm trying to catch up.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that, like what it took for you to start looking into things.
So I was living in Santa Monica, California, during the lockdowns when they started, and I was a CrossFit coach. I had been an actress and a producer, and at the time I was kind of moving more into public speaking, aerial acrobatic performing, and I was working in the fitness industry as a trainer and a CrossFit coach. And of course, everything shut down. All of my speaking gigs were canceled. I was not able to even train aerial acrobatics because I'm visually and hearing impaired. And that's a lot of what my speeches were centered around. But when you're up in the air 26 feet and the teacher has a mask on, it's already really difficult to hear them. And also that further reduces your peripheral vision. And I already have restricted peripheral vision because I have about 60% of the peripheral vision of somebody who would see binocularly would have. So I couldn't even train, which was really depressing for me. I found myself really, really isolated, depressed, frustrated. Because, I mean, I think the masks were really terrible for a lot of people, but for me, they were even more isolating and really devastating because I learned how to speak by reading lips because I'm hearing impaired and I didn't get hearing aids until I was almost 6 years old. And I didn't realize how much I still depend on lip reading and nonverbal cues until they were all stripped from me and everybody's faces were covered. So without making this too long of a story, but, you know, I was trying to figure out what to do. I actually got fired from both the gyms I was working at. I can't prove it, but I would say 99% sure that it was over politics. All of my speaking events and performing gigs were canceled. So I was now really isolated, and I had decided that it was a great opportunity to write. I had been really wanting to write for a long time, but at the end of the first day of the lockdowns, I found after 10 hours, a beautiful white screen staring back at me and decided that this might not be their time to write. So I realized I was just too depressed and anxious and just feeling the weight of, you know, I'm an empath, so I don't think it was just my own emotions that I was feeling. It was really the weight of the world that I was feeling. And so I decided that, you know, I knew enough about the creative process and knew that I couldn't force it. So I decided that I would do some reading because I hadn't had a whole lot of time to read. And now was like a great opportunity for that. So I ordered 11 books that day and I started reading voraciously and found
Do you know which 11 they were? I'd be curious to hear.
Yeah, I don't remember all of them, but there was, I ordered Jordan Peterson's Maps of Meaning. I ordered a couple of Roger Scruton books. They were mostly in the philosophy and psychology realm. Yeah, so there was a couple. I think there was one on physics. I think it was the Michio Kaku's The God Question. So I don't remember all of them, which 11 I bought that day, but those were some of the top that I bought. Which definitely started me down a rabbit hole. I mean, it was a very different trajectory, but it was kind of a bit of a gateway because I did start listening to a lot of podcasts. I you know, really went down the Roger Scruton. I loved him. And through him, I found Jordan Peterson. And I started listening to the Intellectual Dark Web. And, you know, I ended up going on a very different path. But yeah, that definitely opened a lot of, you know, a lot of questions for me, certainly. Because I had really never listened to a podcast before 2020. Yeah, I know. And so a lot of people suggested that I start a podcast, and the idea was actually really terrifying to me. And then it dawned on me that even if I didn't release a single one, like I never aired it, just having even on a screen naked face conversations with people might save my life. And, you know, I hesitate to say it that way, but I actually really mean it. I mean, I was really feeling depressed and isolated. So it just having meaningful conversations where I could actually see people's faces, I thought would do a world of good for my morale. So yeah, it was really a result of doing all this reading, and I started, you know, posting on social media, and I now wanted to talk to people about all these things that I was reading, and I chewed my mom's ear off for a very long time. But people did reach out suggesting that. And that's when I said, okay, well, it took me a long time because I was thinking, well, I don't know what I want to talk about specifically. You know, I had a very wide array of interests. I didn't know what to call it. That's why it's just the Courtney Turner podcast. But I really thought that I wasn't sure where it would go, but I really thought the idea of, even if it was over a screen, being able to have meaningful discourse with people would really be wonderful. So I started and I loved it. And yeah, but the beginning where I started, I feel like it was very different from the trajectory I ended up following. So
yeah. And you ended up getting out of Southern California, right?
I did. Yes, I left Southern California. There were several incidences, but I would say there were three big ones where I was finally like, okay, I have to leave. One of them was where because I was getting these chalazions in my eye. I actually have one now, but these were being caused by the mask, you know, because of all the, and I wrote an article on this, actually. There's a doctor in New York who was talking about how all of her clients, not all of them, but a lot of her patients she was seeing this way more often than she'd ever seen it in her entire practice. And it was a result of the mask, and she went through the science behind it. But I was getting these, you know, infections in my lid, and it was very concerning to me because I'm blind in the other eye. And I went to the eye doctor to have it checked, and they told me I had to wear a mask. Now, I was in a huge waiting room, like completely empty. And I had one of these masks that had, it was like a mesh, like sparkly mask, and it had holes in it. And so I could breathe, but they told me that that wasn't sufficient, and I had to put on one of their masks. And then because there was nobody there, my eyes started burning when I had it on for a period of time. I took it down so I could just breathe for a bit. They came over, told me that they were going to bring security up, and they did. And security, I kid you not, it was something out of like a dystopian science fiction novel, but they circled me like in a semicircle and started chanting, comply, comply, comply. I'm not kidding.
Oh my God.
It was literally like that. And then finally, someone broke what felt like was a seance. And he said, I'm sorry, you're going to have to comply and put on your mask. And if you do not do that, we're going to have to escort you out and have you arrested. And I didn't know if they really could. I mean, it was security, but I was scared enough that I basically said, I'm just going to leave. I'll escort myself out. And it turns out that there's this weird gray area with security in a hospital that's attached to a school where they're not police, but they're not quite security, and they can refer you to the police. So, I mean, they do have the means to, I don't think they can arrest you, but it's definitely a weird gray area. So I'm glad I left. But that was one of the final straws. After a few weeks before that, I had been chased by a woman who was wearing a mask, and she had a knife in her hand, and she started chasing after me, screaming that I was a murderer. And she didn't see anything ironic about this. My bare face was a threat to her existence, but her knife pointing right at me apparently was not a threat to my existence. So, yeah, so that was pretty scary. And then the third one was where I was leaving a voice clip, and I had one of these wallets that was attached, like, you know, my keys, basically my whole life. I now have one of these straps on it. I don't wear it. I don't just have a thing in my hand, but it's basically a wallet phone holder.
Yeah.
And I was leaving a voice clip, and this guy comes running towards me, snatches it out of my hand. It's broad daylight, basically right by where I live, really close.
Outdoors? Outdoors,
oh, broad man. Daylight, lots of people all around, snatches it out of my hand. And I started running after him, and I realized pretty quickly there was no way I was going to catch this guy. So I started screaming at the top of my lungs and pointing, you know, get that guy. He stole my wallet. He stole my phone. And people actually got in their cars, and they started to chase after him. And finally, someone on his bike was able to hunt him down and retrieve my belonging.
Wow.
Right. And then I realized I was very, very lucky. I realized that I was right next to a liquor store where they probably had security cameras. And so I went in there and I called the cops, and I said, could we please look at your security cameras? And they were so resistant. Now, I don't see all that well. I just told you I'm blind in one eye, right? So I'm looking at the camera, and they keep saying, I don't see anything. Do you see anything? I mean, they're totally playing dumb, and they just obviously didn't want to prosecute or to, you know, make any kind of effort. And I'm like, it's right there. Pause, you know, and I showed them the whole thing. It was so obvious. And they asked me if I wanted to press charges if they found him. And I was like, no, I just thought this would be really fun to just, you know, waste my time, you know. But I did. They said, wow, that's really brave. And when I came back out, I went to the restaurant where I was meeting people. Like, everybody clapped because they watched the whole thing. It's this broad daylight in what was a really nice area. So I at that point really didn't feel safe. It was very close to where I lived. And the three strikes and you're out. So that was the third time that was not so charming, and I left.
Yeah, you ended up in Tennessee, right?
Yep.
Yeah, we've got a lot of friends that did that move. I got your number from Scott from Rebunked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm an Oregon guy too. I lived in suburban Portland throughout the whole, probably the first half of the whole problem with the air. And it was tough, you know. I navigated it as well as I could. But yeah, just that feeling of separation and depression and feeling alone is like what forced me to start this show. Also, you know, I'd gotten kicked out of Trader Joe's like the day, and I was just feeling, it was real early on, you know, and I got kicked out of Trader Joe's because I had my mask down. It was over my mouth, but my nose was out, and like got kicked out. And then so that's when we started the show, like that afternoon. That's what gave me the motivation to do it. And but luckily, you know, summer of 2021, right, Deborah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, summer 21, we moved, you know, an hour and 10 minutes away from Portland. We live out in the middle of nowhere and got like a bunch of land and stuff. Hold on, nice. my little pit bull's going wild.
Oh.
But yeah, so, and then we, like, even though we're, Deborah's been to our place a bunch of times, even though we're an hour from Portland, like, it looks like the Ozarks, you know, or like Appalachia.
You're in the middle of nowhere. It's just beautiful.
And there was no compliance where we lived. So I live like in the county, I live on the last county in Oregon. And then like I do a lot of my business in Southwest Washington. So, and there's like none of it. So it was really cool to be able to do that. And now I get to live out here full time and homestead and stuff. But I like your story because I am pretty much not legally blind because I've never been diagnosed that way. But if I had to test or something like that, I think that's the way I would come up. And I too got kicked out of the optometrist and had to suffer with my old prescription for another 6 months or a year. I can't remember how long, but yeah.
Yeah, I had one doctor actually send me like a handwritten note telling me I was not allowed back in his office.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was like, you guys are doctors, you're medical, yeah, professional. This is how you're behaving. It was bizarre. It was just very surreal to watch.
Yeah. Yeah. Tennessee seems like a great place to be. It's a lot of, it's been in the news a lot though lately. And it seems like it's a very freedom centered place. And it also seems like maybe that they know that. And there's a lot of other stuff going on. And, Nashville or wherever is, I'm not quite familiar with all the cities there, but I think Nashville close to where you are?
It's about half an hour. Yeah.
Cause I know that's where Scott kind of ended up in.
I didn't want to be in a city. I mean, I guess it's a suburb, you know, I wasn't quite ready to go out to the middle of nowhere just yet. I needed the transition, but I definitely didn't want to be in a city. I mean, I grew up right outside New York City. I lived in Manhattan for years before I moved out to LA. So I was pretty much done. And truth be told, this was really the impetus for me, but I think I was really done long before. And it was just finally, you know, the sign that I really needed to take action. So,
yeah, it's just taking those little steps though. So like suburban living now, we'll get you ready you start doing a garden, get some chickens where you're at now. And then like, in a couple of years,
my fiance keeps talking about that. He's very into permaculture and really wants to find some land. And
what we did. We left San Francisco in 2018, because I was like, oh, I'm not welcome here anymore. Unfortunately, we ended up in suburban Portland. And we're able to kind of, where when we moved out to our house in the suburbs from San Francisco, it seemed like we were like out in the middle of nowhere. And now when I have to go back to that area, I go to church right by there, it's like I have like sensory overload now when I have to leave where I'm at.
That's so funny, because when he first moved here, he said that to me. He's like, you live in the city. I'm like, no. He's like, yeah, you live in the city. Like, you can hear all the noises and just, yeah, it was just so funny to me. I'm like, this is like really suburbia. I mean, it's really not the city. I've lived in the city most of my life. So
yeah,
but just the perspective is interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, just those that suburban time will get you ready for the next step. And it's just little incremental steps. But yeah, I'm really happy that you navigated that well. And I'm sorry you had to go through all that stuff. But sometimes that's the stuff we got to do to get to where we're at now. And if you hadn't got there, we wouldn't be having you on to learn about elite, out in the open NGOs, secret societies. I don't even know what we call it. I asked you to come on to tell us about Tavistock. And you want to get into that with us? You told us that you found Jordan Peterson. How did you find like Tavistock and all this stuff? I've heard you on with Jay Dyer and his wife Jamie. I love those guys so much. As time goes on, like I was just saying earlier, like I'm kind of done with. I can talk about all the other weird, crazy conspiracy stuff, but like listening to Jay Dyer talk about it, like from the text that they've written,
right,
is what really makes a difference to me. And I share the same theological philosophy as him, so coming from it from that way helps me out a lot too. But how did you learn about, go from where you are to Tavistock and you know all that stuff?
So I would say Tavistock was probably my red pill. And interestingly enough, Tavistock is actually how I met Jay, because once I discovered Tavistock, I was looking for people who could teach me. There's so few people who were talking about it that I was looking for anybody who would know something about it to talk to. And I found Jay, and I wasn't familiar with him before that, because as I said, I was really very much a normie. And it's funny, I've had that conversation with him. He's like, really, you were a normie? I was like, total normie. Yeah. Like, I can't see that. I'm like, no, total normie. And I really started my podcast. I grew up a pretty conservative. I didn't know it at the time, but my dad was very much a neocon. And I don't think I even knew that. You know, I thought he was like just Republican and conservative. But I was, pretty aware of politics from a very young age. Just to give you a little sense of how engaged I was, in sixth grade, I had actually started a board for school choice. 6 years later, the school actually did implement school choice. I can't say that I was the one to effectuate that change, but I'd like to think I did. Although now in hindsight, I realize that was very much a lie, you know, and school choice is not this great savior that we are led to believe it is. But at the time I thought it was. And so just that's just to share that, you know, I've been engaged from a pretty young age. And when I started this podcast, I was one of those people who definitely believed we just needed to vote harder. You know, I thought we could just get the right people in office, we could solve this whole big mess. And I used to say that the problem was that, you know, the Republicans are behaving as controlled opposition to the left. But as I started to dive into this research, that shifted pretty quickly to know they were created to be controlled opposition for the left. And so that's kind of where one of the biggest shifts really came about for me. I would say that's kind of one of the paradigm shifts that, you know, red-pilled me, so to speak. But Tavistock, somebody had sent me, I started to talk a little bit about some of my journeys. This was in, I guess, very late 2020, maybe even early 2021. And a friend of mine had sent me a video of Dr. John Coleman talking about the Committee of 300. And I was like entranced. And I started trying to find everything I could on Dr. John Coleman. And I found his Committee of 300 book, which is probably the episode that you saw. We were covering that book. So I read that. And then I found his Tavistock book. And it sells for almost $5,000 on Amazon.
Yeah, and Deborah was talking about that one earlier.
Listening to your podcast, I went in search of it. And of course, I couldn't find it, but I did find that one.
Yes, I have that one as well. That's on my bookshelf. Well, I've actually finally printed out. Wait, where? Yes, there you can see. I finally printed it out.
Uh-huh. I like the pink sparkly binder that you got. That's thank you. Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. My binders have to be pretty, but yeah.
It's like a trapper keeper. You got to get a rude dog trapper keeper to put one in.
Well, it's too small to fit in one. So this is the second half. Yes. And this is the Committee of 300 book. The other book I have of his that people don't talk very much about is called Diplomacy by Deception, which is actually really, really good. I have one on the Constitution also. It's like what Americans don't know about the Constitution. I recommend that as well. But yeah, so Tavistock, I realized that was like the modern day version of book banning, is where they make it too expensive for the masses. And I noticed that there were several other books like this. And so when I saw it was that expensive, I, of course, had to read it. And so I read it online. I found the PDF and I read it literally three times in 1 week because I was so riveted by it. And then I found Dan Estulin's book. I read that as well. Dan Estulin quotes Dr. Coleman a lot in that book. So it's a lot of repetition, but he does some good work in there as well. And that really, I think it spoke to me so much because of my background. I had a really strong background in philosophy, psychology, and I was an actress and producer. And Tavistock kind of works on all of those arenas, you know, with the social scientists and psychologists and psychiatrists who are creating, you know, the social engineering and the propaganda. They do all the testing and the research in order to create that propaganda to socially engineer the masses. And then, of course, it's, you know, that's born out of the philosophies, things like the Marxist philosophies. There's a lot of overlap with the Fabians and the Frankfurt School. And Tavistock is kind of where a lot of those converge. And then, of course, they do a lot of this infiltration through the arts, through Hollywood, through music, literature, plays. So I think just because of that background, I was so fascinated by Tavistock and the control that they had, and that it was this, it seemed like this monster think tank that acts as a shadow government in many ways. And I had never heard of it. And I didn't know anybody who had heard of it. So yeah, that was kind of really what sent me down the path, because it really shifted my paradigm of just how I saw things and realized that so much of what I thought had been natural, organic culture had really been manipulated and created for the purposes of controlling and steering the population.
So did the Tavistock Institute come out of the Committee of 300?
So that's the theory, according to Dr. Coleman. So what we do know, you know, there's a lot of things that I can't say definitively, but what
you can speculate, you
what we do know. We can speculate, but we can also connect dots, right? So yeah. I can give you data points. What we do know for certain is that there was a British propaganda bureau that started around 1912. And there's, you know, were some things that were building up to that. But essentially, you know, this is always done under the guise of wartime research. This is where, you know, now our Pentagon, we get a, I always use the example of ARPA became DARPA. Essentially, they put a D in front of it and they get a black ops carte blanche budget to do whatever they want. And, you know, ARPA, not to say that ARPA didn't have any covert operations. I'm sure they did. However, they were much more transparent, because they had to be. But once it's done in the name of defense, they don't need to tell the masses what it is that they're using that budget to do, or what the research specifically pertains to, or when it will be utilized, or if it will be utilized. So, you know, we see that with things like MKUltra, which I believe Tavistock really paved the way for MKUltra, a lot of that research, shell shock therapy. So I digress, go back to around 1912, 1913, Germany had a propaganda bureau. It was literally called a propaganda bureau. And so, of course, Britain decided they needed a propaganda bureau because their enemy had one. And the primary purposes, it was held at the Wellington House. The primary purposes of this propaganda bureau was to garner acquiescence to engage in the war, both for the Britain population as well as the United States, but primarily the United States.
They had to make people hate Germany, right?
They did, but not just hate Germany. They had to make the Americans want to engage in the war. Surprisingly, they really didn't. Americans were much more isolationist, and this was the term they weaponized, actually, in 1916. Yeah. Tavistock weaponized the term isolationist. And we later saw this with Ron Paul recently, right?
Yeah.
More recently, where a lot of people on the political right really liked Ron Paul's, fiscal policies and some of his, other policies. But the thing you kept hearing was, his foreign policy is crazy. I mean, he's an isolationist. And they said it like it was a dirty word. But if you go back in history, Washington actually warned the American public about engaging in foreign wars. And he also warned about party systems. And he said that would allow for foreign entanglements and foreign engagements that would intermingle and be able to co-opt our systems and work against us. They would be able to essentially do what they call, you know, now it's like the divide and conquer strategy, right? They can create these false dialectics and manage dialectics. And Washington actually, in his farewell speech, warned us about this. So Americans really weren't very interested in engaging in other people's wars. So there was a lot of propaganda that was necessary to create that desire and that possibility. Because although, you know, we don't think about it these days because the Constitution has been very much overwrought in many ways. But really, the commander-in-chief is not the commander-in-chief until war is actually declared. And war has to be declared and has to go through Congress, right? It's not like it can just be one. We have three branches, and the executive branch doesn't just get to call it. So, but that we don't really see that because that's not really how things operate today. But because in the past it did, you needed some sort of agreement, and the American public was not very interested. And so Tavistock's, one of their main jobs was to create this propaganda for us to engage in World War One, and they worked very closely with Wilson. This was part of the whole Federal Reserve Act that we got on,
1913, right?
Yeah. 1913 was a very big year. It was definitely a big year for Tavistock, and they worked very closely with Wilson on creating a lot of that propaganda centered around the, you know, financial systems, the, engaging in war. And many, many historians have said that we would not have been able to, we wouldn't have even been able to go into World War if we didn't
without
have
a central Federal bank, Reserve. Right?
Yeah. And the Federal Reserve Act. Yeah.
Is there any specific examples that you can point to that would steer the American public's opinion at that time to get them to endorse going into a foreign war?
Say that again.
Are there any specific examples that you can think of? Like, what did they do to the normal American lay person to make them support?
Well, I mean, one of the things they did do was weaponize that term, isolationist. You know, that's like you need to engage, and that was like a bad, dirty word. That was one of the things that they did. I'm trying to look and see what some of the other things they did.
They had all those comics with like the Hun comics and the babies mm-hmm. on bayonets and stuff. Have you ever seen those, Deborah?
No.
There's all they were calling Germans Huns, and it's the exact same. Remember mm-hmm. Naira with the babies in the incubators in Iraq? Remember that one?
No,
I remember that.
I do.
Deborah,
not.
We covered it on the show a long time ago.
Okay.
When they we didn't want to go into a lot of the. Congress didn't want to go into Congress declares war has to go through Congress for war, right? A lot of Congress is that right? Am I saying that right? A lot of Congress didn't want to go into mm-hmm. Iraq one.
Yeah.
And so they came up with this story that this 15-year-old